Greetings and salutations. In the over $135 billion video game industry, online is king. For most online gamers, competing against other players around the world is an enjoyable pastime. But for some, they can't just take a loss or a little bit of trash talk. No, they've always got to push it a little too far. And that is where swatting comes in. Swatting is the completely idiotic online gamer revenge prank where someone makes a fake emergency report, often of a murder or hostage situation, at someone else's address. And swatting was at the heart of a recent tragedy here in the United States when in Wichita, Kansas, police accidentally shot and killed Andrew Finch, a father of two, who had nothing to do with the online gamer beef that motivated the swatting call to his address. It was truly a case of wrong time, wrong place, wrong man. Thankfully, the gamers responsible for the made-up emergency that resulted in Mr. Finch's death have pleaded guilty to their crimes, including 25-year-old Tyler Barris, who was sentenced to 20 years in prison for being the man ultimately responsible for making the call that led to Mr. Finch's tragic murder. And while justice appears to be served on the gamers, one can't help but wonder, what about the man who actually pulled the trigger? Kansas City Police Officer Justin Rapp, who shot and killed Andrew Finch after he stepped out on his front porch to see why police lights were outside. By all accounts, Finch posed no threat, yet was still shot down by the officer who has not been charged or really punished for his actions. I think it's time to start asking some hard questions about the tactics and mindset of our police forces who, because they appear to answer every call, no matter its veracity, like it's a siege on Fallujah, and actually inspire this dangerous form of online gamer revenge. Now let's start watching the Hawks.
Want to know what's going on in your city, in your streets? Never back down like Tyrell, and the truth is what you seek. To analyze, investigate from the bottom to the top. You speak your mind like Sean Stone, whether they like it or not. I got Tabitha, Miss Wallace, with the wisdom and the pearl. Between the outrage and the evidence, what's going on in this world?
Watching the Hawks, watching the Hawks, watching the Hawks. Listen when they talk.
Welcome, everyone, to Watching the Hawks. I am Tyrell Ventura.
And I'm Tabitha Wallace. This is one of the many reasons, as you said, why I don't game online very often in co-op or any of that, because it's a very, very toxic place for someone like me alone, is that if you're a woman, it's really hard to online game.
Yeah,
it's really hard in general. And I think a lot of this, as I've talked to you about, a lot of this, I think if it had been sort of nipped in the bud a few years ago when Gamergate was in full swing, because that's what they were doing. They were calling up about women who didn't like the fact that they were horrible.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, it was about ethics and games journalism, blah, blah, blah. But for those of us who didn't care about ethics and games journalism, it became this whole thing where there was swatting or there was this, you know, calling, threatening that they were going to do that. And it's horrifying. It's horrifying, too, one, that someone would do that. And here's Tyler Burris, as you said, Barris, who made the call and pleaded guilty. Kudos for him for pleading guilty and taking responsibility. But he did this dozens of times. He called in a bomb threat, active shootings, and a bunch of other criminal activity at high schools, shopping malls, and even at once called in a fake threat, to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And a 17-year-old from Ohio is facing 140 counts of delinquency, including misdemeanors and felonies for a series of 911 swatting calls that resulted in one case where a SWAT team reportedly shut down a major highway for hours. But here's my question. When did SWAT teams become so incompetent? They're supposed to literally... There was a time when SWAT teams were highly trained to handle a hostage situation, were highly trained, who knew not to just run in. That's why you waited and called them.
Right.
What happened to our SWAT teams?
That's what I mean. What I was just saying earlier at the start of the show was, like, we have to question our police tactics if they're so aggressive that, you know, some 19-year-old kid who's angry at another 20-year-old kid on the other side of the country, you know, says, ooh, I'm going to get him, I'm going to send the police to his doorstep. And it works, you know. Thankfully, this happened a lot of times. thankfully and tragically, there's only been one instance where someone's been killed.
Yeah, this is one,
you
surprisingly.
Know, but when you have, like, SWAT team basically kicking in the door on some dude you don't like online, that does, A, the person who made the phone call is an idiot and should be held responsible for that.
Yeah.
But B, what does that say about our police tactics that they so easily fall for this?
Right.
You know?
And that was the thing we talked about. There's a really hard sort of line that has to be. You're talking about people's lives.
Yes.
And the idea of SWAT teams or these assistant teams are supposed to be the most highly trained.
Yes.
The most thoughtful when it comes to doing these things. And the fact that, you know, a SWAT team opened a door and that someone on a SWAT team thought that shooting from 40 feet away across the street through a whole bunch of your other fellow officers, I might add, if you read the report, he literally shot, like, right in between.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's just I think this goes back to handing off cops a whole bunch of equipment where they think they know crowd control because they have a big plastic shield. They think they know this because they threw a helmet on. They think they know how to actually handle these situations. And these are proving they don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. And Tab, I got to ask you, you know, it's interesting when you see this kind of response, because I understand, like, someone calls up and says there's a hostage situation, someone's been killed. You're naturally going to take it as an emergency, legit call. In fact, I believe Barris even called under a number from which, even though he lived in California, he actually faked them with a number that was, like, registered in Wichita, Kansas. So they're going to react, but no one walks up to the door and says, like, maybe we should just make sure that this is happening first before we go guns blazing. And, you know, given how hard it is to get the police to, it's amazing that it's so easy to get the SWAT team to do this when it's so hard to get them to respond to actual, like, online threats, like you've talked about before, Tab. Where, like, you know, someone threatens a woman online, how many hoops do you got to jump through just to get the police to get through that?
You don't, because unless they are very specific, I have to make sure that they are specifically telling what knife in their personal collection they're going to use to murder me with. Otherwise, oh, honey, it's just talk.
Yeah, yet they can make a phone call and a whole SWAT team can show up. Like, that's, oh, man.
Being able to engage with our elected officials in a meaningful way has become more important than ever as regular voters and big money lobbyists fight for even a few seconds of a politician's time. That's where this voter voice came in. The grassroots advocacy and community engagement company owned and run by artificial intelligence and data mining company Fiscal Note was found to be a bit lax in its security of the data they were mining in the name of activism. The morning of April 5th, it was revealed by TechCrunch that security expert and researcher John Wethington had uncovered that the voter voice storage server was what they call fully exposed. What this means, as Wethington tweeted, was that millions of messages, hundreds of thousands of personal email accounts, latitude, longitude, GPS coordinates, religious affiliation, grassroots and advocacy group associations, and more. What's worse, according to them, voter voice and Fiscal Note still haven't fixed it and have stopped responding to them. According to their website, the Voter Voice software has 21 million supporters or users, 42,000 advocacy campaigns, 117,000 email broadcasts to those users, and over 36 million messages to elected officials and policymakers. We reached out to Fiscal Note and Voter Voice for a statement, but they did not respond to us either by the time of this broadcast.
Tab, you were laying this out to me. This is a massive amount of people's information that's been exposed.
Yeah, and it's why I've been very, I'm very careful, and you've been seeing this over the last few years, of just, you know, push a button and it'll generate a letter to send to your elected official. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a great idea, except those emails, honestly, aren't going to make as much of an impact as something else. But also is this idea of, so now they know somebody's got all this information, where I am, where I'm sending it, who I'm sending it to, what my political views are, what my religious views are, what my sexuality, my gender, my everything. I mean, they have all of this information and the things they care about. And now it's literally just sitting out there unprotected.
See, that just sends chills up my spine, because it's like, look, we already know that people were surveilled and all that over and over again, but you know, voting and what your political beliefs are and all these things you just listed off, those are very intimate details.
It's private. Your vote
private
is
information.
Private.
Yeah. Like, this is ridiculous that they allowed this kind of breach to happen.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised. First of all, this so Fiscal Note's been around for a little while, and they're the ones who bought this voter voice software, and they're sort of, which makes sense because Fiscal Note needs data in order, and data that's readable. Not all government stuff, not all of these things is readable through like machine learning. So they can use that on that data that they're collecting with this software. And what they do with it is predict the outcome of votes in local, state, and federal elections for legislation, so bills. So it's like Nate Silver, but the added bonus of they have access to the voter information as well. So back in 2014, I just want to play this to get an idea. Founder Tim Wang, founder of Fiscal Note, had some interesting remarks about the past when asked whether the future of politics was in data and predictability. Let's take a listen.
Yes, I think it's really interesting where the political and legal scene is today. I actually, you know, compare it a lot to the financial services industry back in the 1950s and 1960s. Back when, you know, deals were made by handshake, by in-person, people used to price things without math, which is mind-boggling to me in today's age. But, you know, you have these new players come in, right? You know, Bloomberg, Ross Perot, all these guys come in and say, well, wait, hold on one second. What if we actually use statistics? What if we established a baseline of predictability in our markets? What if we could forecast things?
I'm not saying he reminds me of Theranos, but I'm just saying this is what happens when Silicon Valley tries to go from Silicon Valley and take a technology they developed and try to put it against, you know, oh, we'll just get this data and then we can predict with 99% accuracy what's going to happen with legislation.
I love this attitude too that like, oh, somehow like contracts and deals and numbers that just didn't exist prior to 1980.
Not until the movie Wall Street and the 80s. Ty, didn't you know that?
That's ridiculous to me.
They didn't use math to calculate prices until the 70s.
Wow.
These are the people that took a whole bunch of information from took money from very big corporations and stuff, and then also took information from activists and people really, it's pretty bad.
It is. And actually, John Wethington told TechCrunch he agrees with you. Organizations that provide platforms for outreach, advocacy, and lobbying hold some of the most sensitive information about the individuals and clients that their platforms support. That's important to note when you actually look at who Fiscal Note's lobbying clients include. These are massive industries. We're talking, look at this, we're talking Americans for the Arts. We're talking the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, Ohio Manufacturing, you can see it up on your screen, Ohio Manufacturing Association, the National Association of Federally Impacted Schools, and the National Federation of Independent Businesses. These are major clients who's everyone a part of that, all that information exposed for all to see.
Not good.
Not good. All right, as we go to break, Hawk Watchers, don't forget to let us know what you think of the topics we've covered on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, and see our full shows at RT.com. Coming up, Dee Watkins joins us to discuss the incredible life and tragic death of hip-hop artist Nipsey Hussle. Stay tuned to Watching the Hawks.
After the previous stage of my career was over, everyone wondered what I was going to do next. They talked about different clubs. On one hand, it is logical to stay on your home field, where everything is familiar. On the other, I wanted a new challenge and a fresh perspective. I'm used to surprising people, and I thought, why not give it a go? I'm going to talk about football on RT. What else did you think I was going to do? By the way, where is the touchline here?
People in America have no money. And house prices are skyrocketing relative to their wages. But the government says that's not inflation. Healthcare costs are galloping ahead, 10 or 15% a year inflation. The government says that's not inflation. In other words, there's been a concerted and decided excisation of the worker in the United States.
young elephants have come to us after especially brutal poaching incidents, because sadly the baby elephants often do see their mothers not only be killed but also be cut up and butchered.
I do believe elephants smile. I see it in these little ones. Their whole facial expression changes.
NASA officials have speculated that humans, like you and I, could be traveling to Mars within the next 25 years. I hope so. One of the main challenges, of course, will be how to feed all of us star-weary travelers. Well, scientists around the world are now experimenting with space gardening. RT America's Natasha Sweet has more.
NASA is planning on sending astronauts back to the moon in 2024, and of course after that to Mars in 2030. But having fresh produce is vital for our health, and it's something scientists are serious about growing in space. Growing fruits and vegetables in space may sound like something out of a movie, but scientists have actually been working on cultivating produce outside of Earth for decades now, since the 1970s. And it turns out plants do not need gravity to grow, but it's still not that simple. Now, packaged foods tend to lose their vitamins and quality over time, and scientists say it would be difficult for humans to thrive anywhere besides Earth unless they're able to grow food elsewhere. Early attempts failed. Growing plants in space turned out to be too expensive and took up too much room. Since the 1980s, NASA has backed research for growing plants under artificial lighting with added nutrients. But it took a backseat in 2006 when NASA began focusing on rocket technology. But in 2014, funding for a system called VEGGIE was reinstated to the space system. VEGGIE has operated aboard the ISS for 5 years now. There were a few failed attempts at growing red romaine lettuce and zinnias. And China saw a glimmer of hope of possibly cultivating food in space after a cottonseed sprouted on the moon. Attempting to create a mini ecosystem, a self-contained biosphere was designed to raise seeds and hatch fruit fly eggs. But the entire project was shut down after 9 days. Temperatures inside the biosphere reportedly reached so high it was on track to kill all life within it. Scientists are hoping to eventually grow an entire diet independent of Earth, but of course there is still a lot of research ahead of scientists before that can become a reality. In Los Angeles, Natasha Sweet, RT.
On March 31st, the hip-hop world was stunned with the news of the tragic killing of artist Nipsey Hussle. The Grammy-nominated Los Angeles native was known for worldwide for not only his incredible skills behind the microphone, but also for his unshakable efforts to make the world he knew and grew up in a better place. Even the Wall Street Journal, of all newspapers, took note, reporting that while some hip-hop artists celebrate lavish lifestyles and fancy cars, Nipsey Hussle trafficked in some of that imagery, but also included more unusual themes in his music, like long-term investment and career development. Joining us today to talk about the impact of Nipsey Hussle's death and what his career meant to the industry and the community around him is author and speaker Dee Watkins. Thank you so much for coming on, Dee.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You know, Nipsey this week, I hate seeing people get killed. I mean, it takes me back to the 90s when I saw, you know, Biggie and Tupac get shot down. But Nipsey this week is being celebrated for not only his music, but also for what he did outside of his music and his help to the community. How important was his work, both, you know, on the microphone and off the microphone?
You know, you can't even really put it in words, but you see it the way that all of these people are organizing all over the country, having visuals in his name and in his honor. And I think one of the major part of his legacy, besides music, because like Nipsey fans, it's been like, you know, we've been listening to Nipsey hard since like 2010. This was like, last year was the first year he actually went mainstream, signed with a major label, because even though he owns his masters, he was always independent. Mm-hmm. So even though he signed with a label, he still owns his masters. So his legacy is going to be ownership and controlling your art and being able to live from the fruits of your labor. And you just you see people who getting an introductory into home ownership, owning the stores that you shop at, investing in a community instead of running away from it. It's all of the stuff. It's the stamp that he left in music and the stamp that he left in society and culture in general.
I think that ownership thing has come up a lot, and I think it's something that gets lost in the conversations you see in a lot of mainstream media. And that's what the thing about Nipsey Hussle that was so interesting is that he talked about how important ownership of the businesses in your community where you live, owning your home, owning what you create, and keeping control of that. Do you think that you know, who do you think, like, how are we keep that message going? Because it's so important, everything from financial literacy to showing people they can do it. I mean, he was there that day to get clothes for somebody who had just come out of prison. Like, how do we do that in a community? And what were the things that Nipsey really brought to the table and taught everyone? How do we make that community?
I mean, was it Prince that had the tattoo that said slave? You know, like, so, you know, a kid like Nipsey had the opportunity of learning from people like Prince and learning from people like Tupac, who, you know, Tupac had all of these big dreams for the community, but he wasn't able to live out to fully, like, see these things happen. So Nipsey actually did it. Nipsey created jobs for a lot of people. Nipsey owned a lot of land. And Nipsey talked about how important it is. And, you know, unfortunately, he passed away, but him passing away is going to even make that message even more relevant. His music went up 2,000% in streams since he passed away. And so many people, like, who weren't familiar was like, yo, why is this guy getting so much love? All of the mainstream culture vulture type people are looking and saying, wait a second, who is this guy? What is he about? And now they're listening to the music. So I think the young kids are going to be able to, you know, they're going to see how Nipsey saw Pac and then what Nipsey actually did. And then they're going to see what Nipsey did and they're going to take it to a higher level. And I think... And it's a horrible, horrible, sad situation that none of us really, you know, we don't really want to talk about, but we have to. The only good takeaway is that people are going to see it and they're going to understand how important it is to own your art, to own your neighborhood, that making it isn't leaving your neighborhood. Making it is achieving success and then buying your neighborhood and then putting other people on opportunities so that we can make a great place. And you can curb the violence when people actually have an opportunity to make a livable wage. And you can curb the violence when people actually have something that they can own and they can invest in and they can be a part of and it can be theirs.
No, I was just saying it's the idea, instead of, you know, no, instead of selling out, you're buying in.
Exactly.
And once enough of us buy in, and once enough of people of anything, whether it's women or African Americans, any sort of group that's been doesn't have ownership in a scale that, sorry, white men do. Like, there's that white man scale, the rest of us. That we all buy in, and then we have ownership in it. And I think that's really important.
Well, and that's one of the things I want to kind of ask you next, Steve, is the work that Nipsey did, you know, for his communities, talking about, like, what we're all talking about here and doing these things, you know, putting, you know, taking his words and putting them into action. Is that the exception or the rule when it comes, in your opinion, when it comes to, let's say, you know, hip hop artists or even other entertainers outside of that music genre, you know, but have that similar background to his? You know, was he the exception or was that something that's happening, but it's not being reported on?
I think it's new. He's new. Even though he's been around for a while, he's like, this was like his biggest year. This was the first year he went mainstream, first time he was able to get nominated for a Grammy. The first time a lot of people are starting to hear about him. He's been talking the same thing for 10 years. So he's had the language, he's had the skills, he's obviously read a bunch of stuff. He has some great ideas, even as a young man, as a young 18, 19 year old, when you watch some of his old videos, he has some great ideas, but and a lot of rappers do, but great ideas take great money. And a lot of people just don't have it. I think if some of these people were in situations where they actually were getting paid like that, then maybe they would be able to implement those things. But, you know, go back to Tupac. As great as Tupac was and how many albums as Tupac sold, he didn't die a wealthy man. Mm-hmm. You know, Chuck Knight and Death Row and bad record deals and ripoff people got all of that money. Court cases and things like that. So, but I think that Nipsey... along with, like, you know, people like Jay-Z who's been doing this stuff for a while too, these guys were laying a foundation of what it looks like to be successful, to be braggadocious in your rhymes, to have a good time, but to also actually help real people, putting your money where your mouth at and being an example of you know, what this American dream is supposed to be about.
It's interesting because it reminds me of a lyric from Lupe Fiasco, the artist out of Chicago, who said, you know, you can kind of listen to Pac and talk about the gloom, but why not pick a broom up? You know, and I think that's one of the traps we fall into, is it's easy to kind of talk about how bad it is without actually physically going out and trying to make it better.
Everybody talks about it. Everybody wants to talk about how horrible the black situation in America is, how horrible black America is, how black people need this, black people need that. I'm an activist for black people this. I do this for black people. Everybody has all the language, all the little intersection terms and all the little inclusion terms, all that stuff, but they don't do nothing. They don't pick that broom up.
Yeah.
They don't pull up in that neighborhood. They're not helping those kids. They're not addressing those people. This man did it. And unfortunately, this is a scary thing about being accessible, and which is going to make more people want to not be accessible. So he was gunned down for that.
Mm. Mm. I think one of the other things too is those people, like you said, it's about that, about what we're doing and what you're not doing. And I think the media plays a role, because when the LA, when in Los Angeles, there was a vigil for him, and I think we have the video, but there was this vigil, and within minutes there was a loud noise and people ran, and the media pulled on it, and they tried to sell this story within an hour all over social media, mainstream, that there was a shooting, that there was stabbings, that there was this. And it's so sad that that's where they go to, that they take someone who wasn't, you know, that they went to this place immediately, and it puts people at risk. And I also think it's one of those things that the media has to do a better job.
Yeah.
A better job about actually celebrating people who are doing good in their community and not jumping on moments like that, that, you know, show why there's such a sense of community. Like, people try to keep people safe and not jump on that and really report things the way they should. And if you don't understand it, ask somebody on your team.
Right.
To explain it to you.
And we're doing it now.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Exactly.
Do it like that.
Dee, I got to say, thank you so much for coming on today and talking about this tragedy, but also the light that's coming out of it. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
West Antarctica is home to what climate scientists refer to as the most dangerous glacier in the world. That glacier is currently holding on for dear life. The Thwaites Glacier is part of the currently weak underbelly of the West Antarctic ice sheet. Because of the climate change, the glacier has lost over 600 billion tons of ice since the 1980s. Now, scientists using things like satellite imagery are seeing signs that the collapse has already begun. And kids, it's not reversible. We can't refreeze this. So two-thirds the size of the island of Manhattan, the Thwaites Glacier acts as a backstop that keeps the other four glaciers around it attached to each other and, you know, not floating around. So as tall as 10-story building and about the size, the total ice sheet, about the size of the state of Florida, the West Antarctic ice sheet is on track to collapse into the sea, potentially raising sea levels to around up 10 feet.
Wow.
So let's not do that anymore. Let's get some not fossil fuels and take care.
Most definitely, man. That tragic, 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 tragic. All right, that is our show for you today. Remember, everyone in this world, we are not told we are loved enough. So I tell you all, I love you. I am Tyrell Ventura.
I'm Tabitha Wallace.
Keep on watching those hawks out there and have a great day and night, everybody.